We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You know, I'm sure we've told people this before, but when we say good afternoon, we're actually recording this in the morning. Good afternoon is merely for their benefit.
Well, so, I'm wishing you a good afternoon in advance.
Definitely. Oh, there you go. Well, thank you. It's bound to get better now. Yeah. All right, so starting out with local, and the Seattle City Council had an inspiring vote this week.
Yeah, they voted a $4 an hour hazard pay raise for grocery store workers. The it applies only basically to chain and big box grocery stores. So the Seattle Times column bemoaning the hostility toward the business community, you know, Safeway can afford the loss. and this is really something that probably should have happened like a year ago, or close to a year ago. We've asked people to be frontline workers and take extreme, risks with their jobs. Not to mention having to, you know, deal with people who, absolutely refuse to wear a mask, even though it's a state mandate. Maybe especially because it's a state mandate. And, you know, those are folks that we're asked to confront those people and expose themselves to the public every day in a way that is probably not safe from a public health standpoint. And we'll talk about Jay Inslee's reopening order, in a little bit, which I think is spectacularly ill advised, but, this is something that was long overdue, and you know, the grocery industry is complaining that they were blindsided by the legislation, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, Seattle is a relatively small portion of Safeway's global sales or Kroger's global sales, and I think they can. I mean, it would be nice if this were a universal federal mandate, but that's probably not on the plate. The Biden administration has got more than its hands full just trying to catch up with the complete negligence toward the pandemic that their predecessors left them. And we'll talk about that in a minute, too. But it's a good step forward for the Seattle City Council. And, you know, I would love to see a similar kind of hazard pay for, say, delivery drivers. Or some of the other service workers that are exposing themselves to the public on a regular basis, you know, Uber and Lyft drivers, taxi drivers, et cetera. You know, these are considered essential workers, but we don't pay them like essential workers. And it would be nice if that changed.
It's interesting that the Seattle Times editorial board would go against this from the standpoint of, gosh, where are you guys getting your food from? You know, it's like, what, are you sending the hired help out to get it for you or what? I mean, don't they have to get their groceries from the grocery store?
Yeah, but, you know, those are the little people. They don't count, apparently. Yeah.
Well, I also saw this morning that apparently the CEO of PCC had sent a email or letter to Mayor Jenny Durkin asking her not to sign the legislation. So PCC, that, you know, once upon a time was our local hippie grassroots co-op, is clearly changing their outlook on things.
Well, though, that changed 20, 25 years ago. I mean, they've got an entire generation now of corporate leadership that they recruit from the grocery industry. You know, they're former people from places like Safeway and Kroger. And, you know, they were doing anti-competitive practices against other local, you know, hippie co-ops, Central Market in particular. And, you know, going, and this is like back in the 90s, and telling organic growers, well, you know, we're the biggest game in town. If you want to sell to us, you are not allowed to sell to anybody else. That certainly has been undermined by the rise of farmers markets over the last couple of decades. But still, it's not the kind of leadership that you would hope to want from a from an allegedly progressive co-op.
Moving on, another person throwing their hat in the ring for the mayor's office.
Yeah, and we talked about this at the beginning of the show last week, like who's going to run for mayor. None of the people who filed so far are recognizable names. This is not a particularly recognizable name either. She might have the resources to be competitive in the mayor's race, and that's a first for the people who filed. Her name is Colleen Echohawk. She is the director of the Chief Seattle Club, which is a public service agency that helps Native Americans facing homelessness, and has been heavily involved in trying to get services for those folks during the pandemic. So, you know, this is somebody who has a lot of on-the-ground experience with homelessness, which is encouraging. And, you know, she runs a nonprofit, so she has some fundraising chops. Whether she has the ability to raise the kind of money that's necessary to get her name out in front of, you know, 750,000 people in Seattle is another question. There's no question that the mayor's race is going to be extremely expensive this year. And of course, you know, depending on how the pandemic resolves between now and November, it really, as we saw last year in political campaigns, leaves campaigns a little bit in the lurch in terms of social distancing and how do you do outreach to people, because television and advertising is really expensive. And, you know, you can't really door knock every door in a city this size anymore. It's gotten to be a big city now with big city problems and big city campaigns, and the tactics have to change, and the pandemic is forcing some adjustments also in terms of how you outreach to people, because if you knock on doors right now, and a lot of people are not inclined to answer. So
those are just the doors you can get to, you know, when they're actual houses.
Yeah.
People living in apartments, good luck door knocking in apartments.
Yeah, that was something that the Sawant campaign last year, 2 years ago, ran into a lot of problems with. Is, of course, one of their strengths is that they have a tremendous number of volunteers that can do outreach in the community. Well, how do you do that when, you know, Capitol Hill has been transformed to largely rental units of the district that she's in, District 3? And so they had to really pivot to a lot of phone banking to do outreach to people. I mean, they still tried door knocking, but they were able to get into fewer and fewer buildings compared to 4 years previous.
Because essentially they're gated communities as far as apartments are concerned.
Yeah, absolutely.
Vertical gated communities.
Yep.
All right. You mentioned Governor Jay Inslee, and there's been numerous updates this week regarding COVID.
Yeah, quite a few of them. Early in the week, Governor Inslee basically downgraded the criteria that they were using to adjust in the different there's eight different districts in the current plan, eight different regions of the state, and then there's two phases, phase one and phase two, in terms of reopening for pandemic restrictions. And the state made it easier to move from phase one to phase two early in the week. And then on Thursday, Inslee announced that region one and region two will be able to move to phase two. Now that includes the Puget Sound area, King Pierce, Snohomish County. That's region two. And then region one is, Olympia out to the coast, basically, Thurston, Lewis, Pacific and Grays Harbor counties. So those areas of the state will be able to do indoor dining right now. You know, gyms can open and sporting events can open, all with reduced capacity, but it will still help for, you know, small family-owned restaurants that have been struggling during the pandemic to rely on basically on takeout orders and, you know, DoorDash, that kind of thing. There's a problem with this, of course. This week we also found out that the more contagious British variant of the virus that causes COVID-19 has arrived in Puget Sound. That was a reasonable supposition before you know, the United States has relatively limited genetic sequencing capacity compared to a lot of other countries. And so it was relatively slow to identify some of the new variants that are coming into the country. I'll talk about that in a minute. But we knew that it was in California. We knew that it was in the Portland area. And these the patients who had contracted it were all people are identified as having contracted it, were all people who had no history of travel. So clearly they got it from somebody else in the community. So we already have community spread for these more contagious variants. Well, early in the week, Snohomish and Pierce County both confirmed that they had cases of the British variant. And then yesterday, I believe it was King County added to that. So it is in the area now and much more contagious and somewhat more deadly than the original virus. We're seeing that in contrast to some of the other variants that have also apparently arrived in the United States. We had the first confirmed case of the Brazilian variant in Minnesota this week, and then just a couple days ago, we had two confirmed cases in South Carolina of the South African variant. So it's these variations are here. The Brazilian variant in particular is quite concerning because it is both more more contagious than the original and also has much higher mortality rates than the original. Some preliminary studies are showing that the South African variant not only has those capacities but also may have the abilities to dodge antibodies in the body, which basically subverts the vaccines that are currently on the market. So you had vaccine makers this week announcing that they were trying to develop new versions of the vaccine, you know, similar to the way you have new flu vaccines every year for the different mutations that start going around in the winter, trying to develop new versions of the vaccine that will, you know, negate the South African and Brazilian variants. Those are very concerning. So those are in the area now. We're in the middle of winter, so people are going to want to be more indoors because it's not particularly a great time for outdoor dining. And you just wonder why the state is reopening right now. It's certainly not because it's a booming retail season. January is generally the slowest month of the year for retail after the holidays. And you know, you did, and most retail outlets, most restaurants, can't afford the kind of HVAC air filtration systems that would, lend themselves to a potentially safe environment. It strikes me as a really bad recipe for, you know, we shouldn't be reopening anything when there's the kind of community spread that we have right now, just because, the trends have been, flattening over the past few weeks, which is a good sign. But, you know, every time in the last year, every time a state or a country has tried to reopen its economy while there is still community spread of the virus has come back with a vengeance. We've seen that repeatedly. We saw that last spring with states opening prematurely at the urging of then President Trump. We've seen that in different countries. Same thing. That's what's gotten a lot of European countries into trouble is reopening when there's still community spread of the virus. I just don't think this is going to end well, honestly. And it is not time to let down our guard against the virus. You know, you need to keep washing your hands, keep wearing masks, preferably double layered is what they're saying now. And, maintain social distancing, whenever possible.
So what were the criteria that Governor Inslee tweaked earlier in the week?
It seems like
that shouldn't be happening. I mean, if the science was solid at the time, why not stick with whatever the criteria you set up?
Well, I think he's getting political pressure, particularly from people who are on the right who oppose the constitutionality of any kind of public health measures. Inslee is not running for reelection anytime soon. He was just elected and sworn into another 4-year term. So I don't understand it really. There were four criteria that are being used to judge whether a region can move from phase one to phase two, and they adjusted all of those a little bit. There are things like, you know, 7-day average of hospitalizations and that kind of thing. And, you know, the plan that the state finally settled on earlier this month, was a pretty reasonable plan in terms of being, you know, science-based, data-driven, which, you know, the state loves. But, for whatever reason, you know, the state decided it wanted to, you know, move regions along and start the reopening process. And it strikes me that, you know, the most densely populated part of the state, the only two of the eight regions were moved from phase one to phase two, but it represents half the population of the state. So it seems like a sort of a bad precedent to, you know, experiment with those relaxed standards on, you know, half the population of the state, including the most densely populated area, which is the Seattle area. And, you know, I just think it's a bad idea. But, you know, what do I know? I'm not an epidemiologist or a politician.
But there were multiple incidents this week involving the distribution of the existing vaccines to some preferred clientele.
Yeah, the Seattle Times was reporting earlier this week that at least three local hospital systems were bumping their foundation board members and major donors to, you know, basically to the front of the line. Overlake, of course, got a lot of attention, but also the Providence Medical Center up in Everett and then Evergreen Health in Kirkland were reportedly doing the same thing. And it really underscores how capricious vaccine distribution has been without any kind of national plan or national guidance. The Biden administration is trying to put that together, but the Trump administration never did it. You know, they made all this big deal about touting how they, you know, helped get the vaccines developed in record time. And that's true. The vaccines were developed in record time. The Trump administration didn't really have much to do with it. But they also said that they had a detailed distribution plan, and that has turned out to be a cruel joke in a lot of the country. Not just Washington State, but a lot of areas, people are having trouble finding out where they can get a vaccine. The criteria for who is eligible for a vaccine varies widely, and it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. For example, you know, a lot of states are prioritizing, say, people 65 and over, and for sure, they are at risk of the virus and at risk of bad outcomes. But at the same time, you know, people with underlying health conditions have been frequently bumped to the back of the line, and they are statistically more at risk of bad outcomes than you know, relatively healthy older folks. So, you know, it's it doesn't make a lot of sense. And the standards are different from state to state. And you're seeing these reports now in a lot of different states of difficulty with vaccine distribution, where states are running out of vaccine, where people are waiting in long lines or having to drive to different counties to find the vaccine, et cetera, et cetera. Here in the Seattle area, we had the, you know, the hospital scandal with the different hospital systems bumping donors to the front of the line. We also had a couple of different incidents where vaccines had to be given to just whoever was available at the last minute because the freezer failed. This was at Kaiser Permanente a couple of nights ago, and then UW and Swedish literally were looking around at midnight for who would like a vaccine, and they because the vaccine spoils after it's out of a deep freezer for a certain number of hours. You wonder why there aren't redundant systems in place so that, you know, you don't have one mechanical failure like that, suddenly risking spoiling, vaccines that are supply that's very hard to replace. but this is how chaotic it's been. The hospitals and hospital systems and nursing homes and all the rest, drug stores, they've really been left on their own to set up their own criteria and their own logistical arrangements for how to distribute the vaccine. There's not been a lot of support from the federal government or, honestly, from the state government. Washington is sort of middle of the road in terms of how states are doing in terms of being able to distribute the percentage of vaccines that they're receiving from the federal government or from manufacturers. But, you know, there's a lot of room for improvement right now, and a lot of this seems to be done on the fly.
Yeah, I'm seeing, I mean, literally people I know online posting about how much trouble they are having trying to just find out, like, when they are eligible. And then when they are eligible, trying to find a location that they can actually get the vaccine at. And then later posting about the problems with the location, that conflicting info where it says you need to come here in person, and then at the place they say no, you needed to sign up for an appointment, and this is all happening.
And a lot of that is online when older folks who are eligible for the vaccine right now aren't necessarily conversant or don't necessarily have access to online. So right. that seems to be flawed as well, that you don't have a way to accommodate that. There's just an assumption that people have the kind of resources and the kind of, I guess, technical savvy to go online and sign right up. And right. Not everybody does.
Right. A lot of people don't.
Yeah.
This is all happening, like, at the exact same time that we're just hearing about the local three hospitals that apparently are saying, oh, we've got this extra amount of vaccine that we need to distribute. Instead of them reaching out to these people that are desperately trying to get the vaccine, they're instead turning to their donors and saying, hey, you guys have been good to us. We just want to let you in on this little perk that you've come to expect when you get $10,000 a year or more. I mean, it's both mind-blowing and business as usual, you know.
Like I said, it's been very chaotic. And hospitals have really been left on their own. The state has guidelines for who should get the vaccine. But, you know, there's no force of law behind it.
Yeah. And we're looking at, again, sticking with the, we are just trying to, you know, distribute this extra vaccine that we had, and, you know, poor us, we chose our donor list first. But the incident with the freezer fail at Kaiser Permanente demonstrated in that particular example that when push came to shove, hospitals could figure out how to give out what they did have equitably to those that were in need. And they didn't, in that particular instance, didn't turn to their donor base and their board of directors to jab their arms.
Probably so, only because they didn't have time.
Yeah.
Sad to say.
It was also notable that in at least two of those three hospitals that were caught trying to distribute to their donors, I think some of them actually did distribute to their donors, the PR people said, well, we're sorry that people got the perception, and it probably wasn't actually the exact word of perception, but the appearance that we were giving this out to a select group of people.
As apologies, that ranks right up there with, I'm sorry if I offended anybody. I mean, it's just not much of an apology, honestly.
Yeah.
And again, you know, where's the accountability for it? At Overlake, and I believe it also, Providence Everett, they did actually distribute it to their donors.
So the here in King County, with the easing to phase two, that takes effect on Monday. Is that correct?
Yes. Takes effect on Monday.
So.
And I already talked to one business owner this week who was like, no way I'm reopening my indoor dining to people. It's just not safe. And, you know, and I was glad to hear that. And, you know, I hope more small business owners follow that example. You know, the only way we will get control of this virus is to, you know, not open things up until community spread has stopped. And we're a long, long, long way from that right now. Especially right, with more contagious variants coming into town.
Right. But if the state and the federal government don't have a means for supporting these small businesses during this time, then so many of them are put in a bind of open up your business under these limited conditions and know that you're potentially harming people, or you can check box B and just go out of business. Thanks for playing our game.
There's no question that it's a difficult situation for business owners. And that, you know, that brings us to, the $1.9 trillion, relief package that Biden wants Congress to pass next week, because that does include additional money for small businesses that need that kind of help. But, you know, you're seeing resistance to that from Republicans in Congress already. But, you know, we talked the last couple of weeks about what's in that package, and there's a lot of necessary things that are in it in terms of money to helping schools reopen, money for small businesses, money for people who are, you know, unemployed because of the pandemic, and money for people who need food assistance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are the kind of things that, again, just haven't been addressed in the past year. And, you know, we're a long way into the pandemic right now. And it seems like we're just catching up on some of the basics compared to other countries, particularly for the people having to deal with the economic fallout. The $600 check is already spent.
The $600 check was, I think, spent for most people back in April of last year.
pretty much, yeah.
All right. Other developments related to our COVID pandemic?
Well, let's see. I would say, a lot of stuff was happening around the world with the pandemic this week. We saw the world reach 100 million cases, which is a staggering number of people. It's something like one out of every 70 people on the planet, which is kind of hard to wrap your mind around. But that's where we are. And as I said, you know, a lot of countries are having trouble controlling this pandemic, particularly with the new variants coming out, which are now dominant in the UK and parts of Europe. That has really jump-started. They came out at the worst possible time in the middle of winter when people are indoors more. And, you know, it spreads much more easily in those conditions. And we're seeing that. We saw Britain reach 100,000 deaths this week, which is, I believe, the fourth or fifth country to reach that milestone, along with Brazil, India, Mexico, and, of course, the United States. It's just it's very difficult to control this virus. I think even once we have widespread vaccinations and the Biden administration can reach its goal of you know, basically having vaccines for everybody who wants it by this summer, I still think it's going to be at least the rest of this year before we can, you know, responsibly say anything is under control. And even then, it's likely to be something, according to the epidemiologists and public health experts, that we're just going to be living with from here on out. That, you know, we try and get the community transmission reduced, but it's probably never going to entirely go away. The only real modern equivalent of this pandemic, of course, was back in 1918 with the Spanish flu, which took 3 years but did die out. And that basically mutated in a way that made it less transmissible. And that's not what we're seeing this time. What happened with the Spanish flu is that it had one wave that was particularly transmissible, but then it mutated, and the second wave later in the same year in the summer was much more deadly. And that's where most of the deaths happen. It's a very high death toll with that pandemic. And, you know, we're going in that direction again, unfortunately.
Are we seeing in the UK and South Africa, as well, I guess, Brazil, too, with that has these stronger variants, are we seeing proportionally higher death rates in those countries from their variants?
It depends on the country and the variant. Initially, it was thought that the UK variant was more transmissible, but not necessarily more deadly. Now scientists are saying that it's about 30% higher mortality. The South Africa and Brazilian do appear to be substantially more deadly, or at least having patients with more difficult outcomes. And we don't know yet what that looks like in terms of the long-term after effects of infection. Of course, we've gotten a lot of reports from the U.S. and around the world of people who literally months after they get the virus and they've still got lingering symptoms or long-term damage of some sort. And that's not really well understood, and certainly not understood how the variants, compare for that. But, what we know so far is not encouraging. And the fact that at least the South African and possibly the Brazilian variants seem to have some resistance to the current vaccines as well, that's also very concerning. And, all of those are in the United States already. Mm-hmm. And, infecting people who have no history of travel, so it's in the communities.
Well, speaking of vaccines, what new vaccines are coming onto the market in different regions and show any promise?
So there are at least four additional vaccines besides the Pfizer and Moderna that are coming onto the market. We saw the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is developed by Oxford University in the UK. The European Union recommended that be approved in the different member countries this week. So that's out there. We have Johnson & Johnson that Dr. Fauci was talking about earlier this week and saying he thought that could be approved for emergency authorization by the FDA within a couple of weeks. So that's coming online. And these are vaccines that are one shot and do not need refrigeration. So they're cheaper to make and much easier to distribute and use. You don't require special freezers the way Pfizer's do, for example, and you don't have the risk of freezer failure. So suddenly you have to distribute a bunch of doses. But so those are coming on the market. We saw Merck this week drop its project for vaccine. They're going to focus instead on that's big pharma. It's another big pharma company. They're going to focus instead on treatments because, the vaccines have gotten all the attention and they've been developed remarkably quickly. But the world really hasn't made that much progress yet on how to actually treat people. We know hydroxychloroquine doesn't work. We heard all about that. But a lot of the other drugs, remdesivir and some of the others that have been proposed as ways to treat people or treat seriously ill people, really haven't been that efficacious. So I think that's going to be where a lot of drug companies pivot to. And then there's at least two more vaccines that are being sold to different countries around the world that China has produced, and India has starting to produce its own vaccine as well. So there's these several different vaccines that are likely to be out there and being used in different parts of the world going forward. And, the more vaccines that are approved, and as I say, the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines have already applied to the FDA for emergency authorization, and that should be forthcoming probably sometime in February.
Where are the efforts taking place to increase basic protections like, PPE that we continue over, a year later to hear stories that those who are healthcare workers do not have enough masks and gloves and gowns?
Yeah, that was one of the first executive orders that Biden signed last week. After he was inaugurated, was to use the military, I forget exactly what it's called, Military Defense Act or something like that, Military Production Act, for the Korean War era legislation that enables the federal government to compel manufacturers to produce this stuff. And that was one of the first executive orders that Biden signed, was to try and ramp up production of those necessities. It really didn't happen in the Trump era. He did try to we saw another scandal this week where he did ramp up the capacity of ventilators, which was something else that was in seriously short supply at the beginning of the pandemic last year. But the United States donated about 8,700 ventilators to different countries, and the GAO came out with a report this week saying they don't know where those went to. There was no follow-up. Instead of the usual process of going through foreign aid experts to determine which countries should receive ventilators and how many, it was the White House calling the shots instead. It seemed very capricious. Countries that had no cases at all of the virus, like, you know, isolated countries in the South Pacific, received ventilators. And very hard hit countries did not, or received disproportionately way fewer. And, you know, there's questions about maintenance, the personnel to train to operate them. It was just a mess. It's kind of typical of the Trump administration in retrospect, that they just didn't plan anything. They didn't think things through, or they were prioritizing their friends as opposed to those who needed them the most. But yeah, the PPEs, you know, that situation should be improving in the next month or two. Because as I said, that was one of the first things that the Biden people moved to do once they were in office.
Yeah. Yeah. But you would think in a market based system, a capitalist system, that the free market folks would be out there going, gosh, we keep seeing these reports that there's not enough masks. I wonder if we should produce some masks. You know?
You would think so, yeah. And certainly a lot of small producers have stepped in to do that in terms of masks specifically. But in terms of like N95 masks.
That's the kind I was thinking of.
The more serious kind. And, you know, the medical experts are saying now that, you know, wearing a simple cloth mask isn't enough. You need to have two layers, or you need to have some kind of, you know, additional filtration the way N95s do, particularly with the new variants spreading. They're, again, more contagious, so they're harder to stop. Gowns and vials for the vaccine, and there's all kinds of, you know, syringes, all kinds of medical equipment that is necessary to, you know, stand up and mobilize in order to get the vaccine distributed and protect people and protect healthcare workers and frontline workers. And it just hasn't happened. I'm really not sure why it hasn't happened in the last year. Some of those shortages have been addressed, or they've been addressed at different times. Others haven't really been addressed at all, and we've never caught up to where the need is.
On the darker side, I do remember
every side is dark.
Yeah, that's true. I do remember seeing, it was either last week or the week before, where Los Angeles County was temporarily putting a hold on their air quality limitations so that they could start cremating all the extra bodies that are basically piling up from the pandemic in that region. So,
yeah, and the good news is that those air quality regulations were reimposed this week because they've worked through enough of the cremation backlog now. But Los Angeles County has been extremely hard hit. It's the one county in the country that has had over 1 million cases in one county. Think about that. I mean, it's a big county, but still. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one out of more than one out of every 10 people in the county has been infected. And, you know, those have been disproportionately communities of color, poorer communities, communities with less access to health care. It's a microcosm of what we've seen around the country in terms of who gets hit the hardest and who has the poorest access to health care when they need it the most.
Yeah, and that's going to be some pretty eye-opening data when it's finally compiled on who is cashing in on all this and who isn't. I suspect the situation that happened with the three local hospitals is probably happening with a lot more hospitals around the country. And when that all comes to light, I think you're going to have a lot of very upset people.
Yeah, and I don't think it's just hospitals. I think, you know, you're seeing that at, you know, community clinics and nursing homes, wherever the vaccine is distributed. You're seeing these stories around the country of young, seemingly healthy people being able to either buy their way in to the line or, you know, being able to take advantage of appointments when other people don't show up for them, you know, and basically cutting in line. This is something we've seen from a number of different states. It's a real problem, and it's primarily a problem of, well, how do you enforce this? Because, you know, the clinics or the healthcare providers, you know, they take the vials out of the freezer and they've got a certain amount of time to use them. So if somebody doesn't show up for the appointment, what do they do? This has been a recurring problem in a lot of parts of the country.
Then moving on to other national news and, President Biden, signing some more laws, or I believe it was executive orders.
Yes, he's up to 33, I believe now, executive orders since he was sworn in, 10 days ago. Probably the most notable ones this week was, executive order, banning the federal government from entering into new contracts with private persons. That is a hugely positive development. The troubling downside to it is that, immigration prisons, you know, ICE, and ICE is not covered by that order. And that, you know, the private prisons in general are a really bad idea, but the private prisons that ICE contracts with have been seriously problematic, especially during the pandemic. And, of course, especially during the Bush administration with the very punitive approach to
Trump administration.
I'm sorry. Yes, the Trump administration. I will get out of saying that.
Four more years.
Yeah. It'll take a few more years, but and then I'll be blaming everything on Trump. But that was probably the most encouraging executive order this week. There were also a bunch of executive orders trying to address pieces of climate change. Probably the most important there, even though it doesn't necessarily, sound important, is trying to convert the entire federal fleet of vehicles to zero emission, which is to say electric or vehicles, and trying to encourage manufacturers to ramp up to meet that demand. Now, that's just the federal government, but and I talked about this, I think, last week with the mask mandate on federal property and for federal employees. The federal government's the largest employer in the country, and it is the single largest buyer of vehicles in the country. So any kind of order like that, any kind of policy change like that, actually has a huge impact. And hopefully it has a multiplier impact as well, because it encourages new manufacturers to bring vehicles onto the market. It guarantees a market for those vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. The big three automakers in the U.S. have been relatively slow to embrace electric vehicles. But at this point, they're losing market share to startups like Tesla. And so they're trying to scramble to address that. I think in general, when you have Bill McKibben writing a column in the Washington Post saying, you know, this is probably the most significant single day for climate change policy in U.S. history, I mean, admittedly, that's a low bar, but it's still, you know, he's not an easy guy to please. So, you know, these are first steps, but they're really important first steps. And we saw some of those this week as well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right. Kevin McCarthy. Remind us who Kevin McCarthy is.
Well, Kevin McCarthy is the minority leader, a Republican leader in the House of Representatives. And he made the news this week because, number one, a lot of networks are based on the East Coast. I think all of them are. And, you know, they're obsessed about the war for control of the Republican Party and where that party is going to go after Trump. And it's having a hard time figuring that out. McCarthy and McConnell, who's the Senate, was the former Senate Majority Leader, is now the minority leader in the Senate, have taken very different approaches to, dealing with the, shall we say, less hinged members of their delegations. You know, many of whom, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren, Boebert, folks like that, have made a lot of news because they're nuts. They really are. You know, the question is the fringier parts of the Trump base, the types of people who attacked the Capitol on January 6th, is that going to be the future of the Republican Party, or are they going to pivot away from Trump? You would think they would want to pivot away from Trump, given the number of scandals, given the atrocious death toll of the pandemic on Trump's watch. If nothing else, that has personally affected so many people in this country. Something like one out of every 747 Americans have died now from the pandemic. And that second number, of course, is decreasing by the day as the death toll continues to increase. It's not at all clear what Trump wants to do, number one, if he wants to run in 2024. We've got an impeachment coming up, not this coming week, but the following week. That will force Senate Republicans to go on the record once again as to whether they want to countenance, in this case, an armed insurrection in the U.S. Capitol, which is what happened on January 6th and which was clearly encouraged by Donald Trump. And we're finding out more and more about, you know, who participated in that riot, where they were getting their instructions, coordination with people inside the White House and inside Congress. You know, all that stuff is starting to come out. We're seeing it in charging documents and a number of people the FBI is arresting around the country right now. And some of them have, you know, ties to the protests against pandemic restrictions that happened at state capitals last year in places like Michigan and also in Salem and Olympia. We saw the Proud Boys basically being charged as an organization with helping to organize and incite the insurrection last night.
Is interesting because we also saw this week where the leader of the Proud Boys turns out to be a longtime FBI, I believe FBI informant, certainly an informant.
Yeah, so that's been distorted a little bit from the original Reuters report. What they found was that the guy was an informant for the FBI to reduce a prison sentence back in 2014. We don't know anything more recent than that. We have no idea whether he was basically a plant for the feds within the Proud Boys and got himself elected as the president in 2018. We simply don't know. But it does raise the question. And it also raises the question of, you know, like how many other people do they have in the Proud Boys working undercover? I'm reminded of the story, you know, it's declassified a while back, but back in the 50s when the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover was extremely worried about, the communist menace. And so the Communist Party in the United States, approximately 50% of its membership were feds. I'm wondering if that's something like that's been going on with the Proud Boys as well, which would be, you know, not good for them right now, but also disturbing that they've instigated so many instances of violence at different protests over the last year. And, of course, their participation in January 6th as well. So we're finding out more about that. We also saw this week a lot of congressional Republicans sort of backpedaling from the idea of convicting Donald Trump when he comes up for impeachment in the Senate in a week from Monday. There's so much video evidence at this point. A lot of investigative journalists have uncovered different things. The Justice Department is investigating different connections with the White House and people meeting at the Trump Hotel, that kind of thing. There's a real question among Republicans about whether you're going to try and distance yourself from Trump and the sort of authoritarian impulse that he represents, and the lack of respect for democracy. And the preliminary indications are, nope, they're falling right in line again with Trump. And you're seeing this also in terms of legislation in a number of Republican-controlled state legislatures for additional voter suppression bills to be passed. There's a lot of that in the pipeline right now in different states. And you saw it with Kevin McCarthy literally going down to Mar-a-Lago and meeting with Trump on Thursday, and nobody really knows what was in that meeting, but it was probably McCarthy saying something like, please, please don't campaign against my members, because the Republicans picked up a few seats in the House last year and have designs on retaking control of the House of Representatives in 2022. That's a little less likely in the Senate, where Republicans lost several seats, especially the ones in Georgia. But one of those Georgia seats and one of the seats in Arizona are up for election again in 2022 because they were special elections this year. So McConnell is also looking at that and how do I get that control back of the Senate as well? Mm-hmm. And, you know, let me underscore this, that, you know, unless the Republican Party falls apart and is completely reconstituted, right now allowing that party to have control of the U.S. government will be the end of democracy in the United States, because they do not believe in elections, because they can't win most elections fair and square. They can't do it without gerrymandering, without voter suppression, because their policies are unpopular, and because they're idiots, and I would like to believe that a majority of the American populace is not idiotic, or at least doesn't find that appealing. It's as if the know-nothing party were running the United States. And we've seen what happens when they do that. What happened with Trump was a huge pandemic, corruption, endemic corruption, scandal after scandal. And just, the cruelty was the point in terms of immigration policy or not doing anything about the pandemic or targeting black and brown populations in particular. This is a real danger, and the danger has not passed simply because Trump is no longer in power. So it's not time to be complacent about the future of the democracy.
All right. Moving on.
Boy, this is a feel-good episode, isn't it?
It is. Feeling all warm and tingly. But yeah. That might be because I got a leak in the ceiling. Breonna Taylor's grand jury.
Yeah. Three members of the grand jury that led to Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who's a protege of McConnell, who we were just talking about. Cameron refused to indict the officers who shot Breonna Taylor last March. One officer was charged for discharging his weapon in, and it went through a wall or a window into a neighboring apartment. So he got charged with recklessness for that. But the actual bullets that killed Breonna Taylor, excuse me, no charges there. So three of the grand jurors filed a petition to impeach Cameron this week, saying that he did not give them full information when the grand jury returned a decision of not indicting the officers, that they didn't have the full information about what happened and were missing a lot of the context, also included in the recall petition was Cameron's vocal support for the January 6th insurrection in Washington, D.C. He was all on board for that, and some other local issues as well. So it's interesting to see that even in a state like Kentucky, which is the legislature there is pretty much controlled by Republicans. They do have a Democratic governor, but the attorney general is, as I said, Republican, McConnell protege. That, you know, people are trying to have some kind of accountability for the failures of the justice system to hold cops accountable.
You have all of 2 minutes max to touch on Alexei Navalny.
Yes. He is the Russian dissident and opposition leader who has been who returned to Russia after being poisoned last summer and spending several months recovering in Germany. He was poisoned with a nerve agent that is special to Russia. And so Russia has seen these huge demonstrations across the country for a couple weeks now in support of Navalny. His wife also has been arrested. And it's really probably the most serious challenge to Putin's rule in the last 20 years. And you can't think that these demonstrations are going to end well, but particularly in the far east of Russia. And bear in mind, it's winter in Russia. It's cold. But people are turning up in tens and hundreds of thousands for these demonstrations. They really are a big deal. And Navalny himself is kind of a flawed figure. He's not necessarily a friend of democracy. He is, not necessarily – he's certainly not particularly progressive. But he has made a name for himself challenging the overt corruption of Putin's regime. And you understand, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, Putin is basically running a mafia state in Russia. He is unquestionably the richest man in the world right now, because he takes a cut out of every industry. It all goes through him and his people. It's a pyramid scheme. And, the kind of corruption that fosters and the kind of lousy public service that fosters, wears on people after a while. We saw that level of incompetence in the Trump administration as well. I think honestly, that's what Trump aspired to was, having that kind of, pyramid scheme that everything, that he was able to get rich off of being, president for life or something. That's what Putin has created in Russia. And the Russian people are, and there's not a long history of democracy in Russia. They're used to authoritarian leaders, but this one has been particularly bad, and we're seeing large demonstrations in a number of different Russian cities.
All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. So we will plan on reaching out via the magic of a series of tubes to you again next week.
Sounds great. I will be at the other end of the tube for you.